Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of the New Yorker and WNYC Studios.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. For my whole life, and probably for yours, the word socialism has been often used as a form of slander in this country, a kind of rhetorical cudgel.
We are alarmed by the new calls to adopt socialism in our country.
Obamacare and socialism.
Barack Obama is a socialist. He believes in redistributing wealth.
One day, as Norman Thomas said, we will awake to find that we have socialism. And if you don't do this, and if I don't do it, one of these days, you and I are going to spend our sunset years telling our children and our children's children what it once was like in America when men were free.
For some on the right, any social program that used tax dollars was big government. And big government was socialism. And socialism was Chairman Mao sending you to a re-education camp. That's the story. And now, what do you know? We have lawmakers in Washington who are proudly identifying themselves as socialists, democratic socialists, and they're getting a lot of people's attention.
You can be in the private sector and be a democratically socialist business. Worker cooperatives are a perfect example of that. It's not about government takeover. It's about how much do workers have a say in your business? Mm-hmm. Do you have workers on the board?
When Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez of the Bronx and Queens made her historic run for Congress recently, one of her biggest supporters was the Democratic Socialists of America, DSA. Bernie Sanders' run in 2016 was also a watershed in American politics, and he describes himself as a democratic socialist. Jill Lepore is a professor of history at Harvard and a colleague at The New Yorker. She recently wrote about the long, complicated history of socialism in America. Jill, there are polls now that show that a lot of people, particularly young people, are very open to the idea of socialism, that this is not a degraded concept at all, as opposed to capitalism. What's going on now, and what do you think is behind this generational shift in thinking?
There are a number of things going on. One is, recall that the Cold War is over, and red scaring and red baiting just doesn't work as effectively as it once did. You can see that going on now, and it's not really getting a lot of traction. I think it just doesn't really hold for younger people who didn't grow up with the Cold War and don't associate socialism with communism. I think those terms have become uncoupled for a younger generation. Also, the disaffection with people on the left with the Democratic Party, especially younger people, is profound.
So, to borrow a phrase from the world of fiction, what are we talking about when we talk about socialism now? What does the word mean?
It actually doesn't mean anything. I mean, I think that is the problem, right? So that one is people conflate socialism with social democracy. And I would say they no longer conflate socialism with communism. But the historical question this is the sort of state of the field of American historical thinking. We don't ask what people are talking about when they talk about socialism. We ask this long, exhausted historical question, why is there no socialism in the United States, which was first posed in 1906 in that explicit way and has engaged generations of political historians ever since. And one of the things they always stumble over is, what does socialism even mean in the United States? And it does mean things different in the United States than it does in other parts of the world.
Well, how so?
So there are traditions in American political culture that other people would describe as socialistic tendencies that Americans have historically refused to call socialist. So we would say those are provisions of a social safety net. That phrase is used all the time. In the American political tradition, people who do use the term use it to invoke a sense of common weal. A sense of a shared social commitment to justice for all.
So three of the ideas that are currently animating the base of the Democratic Party, particularly on the left, are Medicare for all, a Green New Deal, and higher taxes on the wealthy, a lot higher taxes on the wealthy. Do you see there's a common thread between and among those proposals? And is it, in fact, socialism?
So Medicare for all and higher taxes on the wealthy have a long and august tradition in American history as policy proposals that actually have had a lot of bipartisan support. I don't think they are socialistic. I think they represent the kind of checks against kind of a heedless, reckless, unrestrained capitalism that we might be better off referring to as good government. We don't talk about good government anymore, but a lot of these proposals by people who've been brought into office historically have marched under the banner of good government.
But that somehow seems too what? Too centrist, too bland, to constitute a rallying cry.
Right.
So in Congress, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, first and foremost, has championed a Green New Deal, and that calls for huge economic overhaul to combat climate change. When was the last time we've seen a proposal as sweeping as that?
I think that LBJ's Great Society constituted that scale. It had its own kind of utopianism. It had a similarly large role for the federal government. It was seen as an urgent response to a crisis that had not been solved by other means. I would say, previous to that, the establishment of the national security state in 1948, 47, 49, around then, that wholly new apparatus for essentially prosecuting the Cold War and turning the federal government into a funder of university research and allying the government and the military in a new way would be a similar, you know, from the right intervention of such a scale that was defended on the grounds that everything else would fall short. And that's the defense of the scope of the Green New Deal, right? That nothing else has worked, right? There have been a lot of efforts to address climate change, and we're basically doing nothing.
Now, you've written about Eugene Debs in a recent issue of The New Yorker. The DSA, the Democratic Socialists of America, can trace their lineage to this man. What was Debs' brand of socialism? And he ran for president
Five times. Yeah, so I think Debs is actually best understood as essentially a lay Christian preacher rather than as a socialist. I think that his socialism drew on Christian theology. He wasn't himself a deeply pious or religious man, but the way that he and the people that promoted him presented him to the American public, which was a deeply Protestant public, was essentially as a Christ-like figure. He was a martyr to the cause. Going to prison twice was elemental to his story. Running for the fifth time for president from prison was what sort of wrote him into American myth.
Hmm.
And there, of course, there's a lot. I mean, this is where liberation theology comes from. There is a lot in what the theory of socialism proposes that would seem to ally well with certain understandings of Christianity.
Well, what in the historical moment triggered Debs' embrace of socialism? What happened?
So Debs really started out as a big, you know, party guy. He was a Democrat, but he was a big advocate of the two-party system. Debs was a fireman who shoveled coal for the locomotive. And the railroad workers were incredibly hierarchically organized, and they were paid very differentially. And the more dangerous railway work became and the less responsive the railroad companies were to demands made by workers, the more radical Debs became. And he began to see not only that the brotherhoods needed to consider doing things like strikes, which Debs had long been opposed to, but they needed to form a union. So he formed the American Railway Union, which was a union of all the brotherhoods, in which all the different workers, no matter their rank within the railroad system, entered as equals. So Debs had this kind of vision of the profound equality of the railroad worker, and it is, in fact, that railway union that becomes the Socialist Party.
Now, Debs' background was not as somebody who was a young person who ran for Congress, but somebody who came up through the ranks of the union movement. Do you see any figures like that on the scene now?
I think that Elizabeth Warren wants to call on that. That is part of her campaign autobiography as a gambit, right? That she.
But with respect to Harvard professors, Jill, she's a Harvard law professor.
Exactly. No, I mean, but I'm just saying, like, that's the closest I can get you to. I mean, there are more at the local level. But we live in a much more asymmetrical society culturally, I think, than Debs lived in. I guess I would draw
That's an interesting phrase. What does that mean, an asymmetrical society?
It was a piece of 19th century political mobility that someone like Debs could achieve the prominence that he achieved.
Meaning that if you go through the ranks of Congress, there are very few people coming out of the working class or a union movement or anything like that, and it's filled with millionaires, no?
Right.
Now, I'm not sure what Eugene Debs sounded like, but a young man named Bernie Sanders wrote and produced a documentary in 1979 about him. And in it, Sanders performed some of Debs's most famous speeches.
The little that I am, the little that I am hoping to be, I owe to the socialist movement. It has given me my ideas and ideals, my principles and convictions, and I would not exchange one of them for all of Rockefeller's blood-stained dollars. It has taught me how to serve, a lesson to me of priceless value. It has taught me the ecstasy in the hand clasp of a comrade. It has enabled me to hold high communion with you, and made it possible for me to take my place side by side with you in the great struggle for the better day.
To multiply myself. Bernie Sanders and Eugene Debs are different in many, many ways, of course, but how are they similar in their brand of politics?
I think their willingness to embrace socialism during a time when it wasn't popular to embrace socialism and when it came at a great cost. Their willingness to be ostracized for that and to be on the margins of American politics. Sanders was involved in politics for a long time as a socialist mayor, really sensing himself as part of a long struggle. The basic policy positions that Debs and Sanders endorse, or for that matter, Ocasio-Cortez, are quite similar. There cannot be monopolies. There need to be higher taxes. There need to be workplace safety measures. We need to have a federal government that provides a safety net that can protect ordinary people from the ravages of unfettered capitalism. Also, Debs, like Sanders, did not understand socialism as a step toward communism, which is how many people understood socialism at the time and still do. And so in that sense, are more social, better understood as social Democrats, right? Like they don't believe that the state should be making all the decisions, that there is a role for the free market.
Well, what's interesting to me is when Sanders gave a speech in the last go-around of the presidential campaign, right? I think it was 2014 or 15, he gave a speech about socialism. I mean, he would answer questions along the way, but he gave a speech about this. And when it came to the climactic moment and he talked about who his model was, it was Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who always, always insisted that he was not a socialist and that he was a liberal. How does that square?
Yeah, I think we're back at the part of the conversation where the terms are unhelpful because the way our politics works is to discredit not the idea or the proposal, but the label.
Well, I guess so much so that at the State of the Union address, Trump gets up and basically tries to make the dividing line socialism. In other words, we are, meaning the Trump Republican Party, we are who we are, and the rest of them are socialists. That's the way he was trying to divide it up.
Right,
we will
right.
never
and
be a socialist
country.
That is
country. The old move, right? Like early 20th century move. I think what we're seeing is that kind of shakes loose in a different way. I mean, think about those 1930s of FDR, right? Remember when Wendell Willkie ran for president in 1940? He ran as a Republican. He was a liberal. he famously says, anyone who's not a socialist at the age of 20 has no heart, and anyone who's still a socialist at the age of 30 has no head. Mm-hmm. And that's how he defends himself from the charge, but he doesn't reject socialism. I mean, he gives this sort of famous speech in which he says, I am a liberal. Here's what liberalism means. And what it means is socialism. And that's why Bernie Sanders can point to FDR in that same way. The label becomes toxic, but the ideas carry forward.
And you've written recently that there is, quote, a certain timidity to the new socialism. What do you mean by that? Timid how?
I don't think the specific policy proposals, certainly the Green New Deal has some extraordinarily ambitious proposals, and I think many people find them to be ridiculously ambitious in that regard. But I'm not sure that structurally anyone is calling out what are some of our gravest problems, because I don't actually think that they call out the sort of data monopoly.
You mean the Facebook-Google problem?
The Facebook-Google-Amazon problem. I think that that would be alienating to their younger supporters. I mean, that's why I guess just to return to sort of Deb starting out at the age of 14 working on a train for 50 cents a day and then coming to unionize workers who work for trains, there is no figure here who started out essentially indentured to Facebook and who has come to see that our problems lie with these massive data firms.
It's just so interesting to think of that, the idea that the next politically transformative figure would be someone who's a disaffected data worker at Facebook or Google.
But those corporations are our railroads, right? And the railroad and the internet are quite similar, right, structurally in very meaningful ways. In terms of the degree to which the federal government gave the railroads a pass, like didn't tax them, gave them land for nothing. Like they just, here, you wanna transform the country? We're gonna help you do that. And that is essentially the pass that Amazon has from the federal government too. And maybe I'm missing it, but I don't see these people having that conversation. They wanna reach out to their voters on Facebook. They wanna tweet at them. They wanna send them their t-shirts by Amazon. And they want them to be excited about doing some social media event with them.
Jill Lepore, thank you so much.
Thanks, David.
You can find Jill Lepore's article, Eugene v. Debs and the Endurance of Socialism, at newyorker.com. And Jill recently published A New History of the U.S., a terrific book called These Truths. I'm David Remnick. You're listening to the New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Teju Cole is a novelist and an essayist who writes widely about photography and many aspects of the culture we live in. He's the author of Blind Spot and many other books. Last week, Cole joined me to talk, for reasons that are pretty obvious, about the history and the meaning of blackface. Now, Teju, I've got to ask, what went through your mind when you first saw the photo that everybody's been talking about, the governor of Virginia, either in blackface in a photograph of his medical school yearbook or his admission that at one time he had dressed up in blackface in the 80s.
Right. Well, I think like many of us, I received that information in a kind of a second or third hand. What I mean is that I was already seeing commentary about it before we even understand what the facts of the case are. In this case, the facts were not clear at all. And since Ralph Northam kept changing his story, it wasn't actually clear what kind of responsibility we were talking about here. Was he the one in the picture? It wasn't clear at all. The only strange thing about seeing this particular little thing explode was how unsurprising it was.
What do you mean by that?
What I mean is that a white man of a certain age in the U.S. is found to have done something racist in their past. Well, yes, this is a racist country, and we seem to think that each time it happens, it's somebody who is a bit of it's a unicorn. But what the only thing that happened here is that he was caught.
Do you think he should resign?
It sounds terrible to say so, but I actually don't care what he does one way or the other. What I'm interested in is what kind of conversation is possible out of an incident like this that is not the same old Groundhog Day. Because what I really see here is that it was bad to do what he did, and it was bad for his attorney general to also be in blackface. But how far does that badness go? The public reaction is interesting to me because we think these are bad actors and they should be punished for what they have done. We seem to have an automatic way of talking about that. This person should resign. It's offensive and they're racist. We don't know if they've changed.
In other words, that it's isolated an individual.
Well, what do you do about somebody who, let's say in the 1980s, refused to rent to black people? What do you do about somebody who acted in such a way that they got black people fired or blocked their access to mortgages? How do we talk about the fact that right now in this country, wealth inequality between black people and white people is cavernous? It is immense. That is racism. And yet, I don't suppose most white Americans wake up in the morning and feel personally responsible for that state of affairs. So if Northam resigns, on the one hand, it's the right thing to do. On the other hand, if he resigns, it serves a kind of a valve function of which this country seems to frequently require an example.
In other words, it takes the pressure off and we move on and fail to deal with the heart of things.
It takes the pressure off.
It seems to me that this is, obviously this is the symptom of a much deeper, more widespread disease. And it has been with us for hundreds of years in one form or another. With blackface, just this one manifestation, blackface seemed to recede from the culture during the civil rights movement. And then during the rise of affirmative action, you started seeing it more and more on college campuses, clearly as some kind of reaction.
Right. I mean, it's sort of how, you know, it was after Reconstruction that all these Civil War Confederate monuments went up, right? So there's this sort of like delay, or there's this like a sleeping virus. But the thing with blackface is that it never really disappeared from popular culture, right? I mean, you know the long list of people that we might otherwise admire who have, in one form or the other, done blackface. Is Ted Danson, of course, Fred Astaire, there's Billy Crystal, you know, Shirley Temple, Frank Sinatra, and so on. So I think what it shows is that black people could always be insulted or could always be assumed not to be in the audience that the joke was for. Because after all, this is what it comes down to, a kind of, who are we addressing here? And if we say, well, what Ralph Northam did was problematic, what's problematic about it is not shoe polish on his face. It's that he somehow did not see his black neighbors as fully equal. And he did not imagine a future in which he might have to deal with them as fully equal.
Teju, you were born in the United States in Kalamazoo, Michigan, but you didn't grow up here. You grew up in Nigeria and came here as a...
Yes, I was 17 when I came to the U.S.
For university. Do you have memories of coming here as a teenager and encountering some of this racial imagery for the first time? What were your first memories of that?
Well, I came to the U.S. and I came back to the U.S. as a college student in 1992. And I think at that time when I came here, I did not really understand American racial politics or America's racial history. And this is a peculiarity of the way that African-American history has gone out into the diaspora. So much of it comes to us through a white filter. So, for example, this might sound very odd to you, but when I was growing up, one of my favorite movies was Blazing Saddles, with its extremely foul language and very, very broad humor, very often at the expense of black people or stereotypes about them. And it was Mel Brooks humor. It was gross-out humor. Of course, it would appeal to a 10-year-old. So being in the U.S., and I've been here for about 27 years almost now, has been about learning how insidious racism in this country is.
One of the reasons I wanted to talk to you about this is because you're a deep student of photography, and this issue got raised yet again because it shows up in a photograph that's particularly potent.
That's right.
When you look at, as a critic of photography, as a historian of photography, how does that help you understand American racism, these countless images?
Well, one of the things that I'm most convinced about when it comes to photography is actually a kind of definition in the negative, which is that it is an extremely limited art form. A photograph is made in 1/25th of a second, 1/60th of a second, you know, if it's a long exposure, maybe half a second or 1 second. Everything before that moment, everything after it, we really don't have. And so if I do see somebody in a photo doing something that seems to be racist, my first assumption is that, well, there's a lot more where that came from. not only in that person's personal life and in their history, but in the society that created that.
You know, we use this phrase all the time, over and over again, but is Northam in any way a tipping point? Is there the possibility that this can be used beyond him, beyond his survival, non-survival in his office, that it can be used in a useful way? He's talking about a reconciliation tour, for example. Forget his reconciliation tour. What should reconciliation look like?
David, I think I've learned that when it comes to race in America, there is no tipping point. I mean, there's no tipping point with cesspools. It's just going to be this very, very slow cleanup process. But people have to be willing to do that. I don't see that willingness, really.
Do you think somebody like Barack Obama was overly optimistic? He would talk about, you know, he would employ the King phrase about the arc of justice and feeling always that it's two steps forward, one step back, but there is progress. You seem much darker in your view.
Yeah, I think President Obama mistook his remarkable personal story for a general truth, and it's just not one that really holds. When we consider who succeeded him in the presidency, we already see that was not the case. Now, it's also possible that there is a samba going on here. There's like two steps forward, one step back. It's possible. But I don't know. Maybe it's one step forward, two steps back. You know, the samba is also
that seems
kind
to be
of
the recent samba.
Right. The samba is a complicated dance. Yeah. And then there's all kinds of improvisation and there's sideways moves. But I don't want to end on a negative note because, I mean, you are a keen observer of history, and so maybe you'll agree with me on this, is that when societal change happens, it happens at such a velocity that it takes even the experts in that particular area by surprise. If you consider the speed at which public acceptance for the rights of queer people has happened in this country, it does feel precipitous also. And yet that's like, you know, 50, 60, 100 years of an overnight success.
Exactly. Teju Cole, thank you so much. It's good to talk to you.
It's good to talk to you, David. Thank you.
Teju Cole contributes to The New Yorker and many other publications, and he teaches creative writing at Harvard University. The writer Valeria Luiselli came to this country as the young daughter of a Mexican ambassador. And living here as an adult much later, Luiselli began hearing about children crossing the southern border alone as refugees. And she began thinking about how to write about these children whose experiences of migration are so radically different from her own. She published a nonfiction account called Tell Me How It Ends. And she takes up that theme in her new book, which is fiction. It's called Lost Children Archive. Critic James Wood said that Valeria Luiselli wrestles with these difficult questions. What does activist writing, writing that wants to make a real difference, look like? And how does the privileged author gather the stories of impoverished others and not commit theft?
While the children travel, asleep or half sleeping, they do not know if they are alone or if they are together. The man in charge sits cross-legged next to them, taking puffs from a pipe and blowing smoke into the dark. The dry leaves nested in the bowl of his pipe hiss when he inhales, then kindle orange like a tangle of electric circuits in a sleeping city seen from above. A boy lying next to him moans and swallows a gulp of thick saliva. The wheels of the train spit sparks. A dry branch snaps in the dark. The pipe pit crackles again. And from the metallic intestines of the train, a sound like a thousand souls shrieking can be heard all the while. As if to pass through the desert, it had to crush nightmares in clusters.
That's Valeria Luiselli reading from Lost Children Archive. She spoke with The New Yorker's fiction editor, Deborah Treisman.
So your new novel, Lost Children Archive, it tells the story of a family of four that goes on a road trip, which is set against a backdrop involving immigration at the southern border. And there are sort of stories within the stories that involve undocumented children who are lost or displaced. You started working on this book, I think, long before Trump made the southern border a big item of headline news. And I'm wondering how it all started for you.
I did. I started the novel in 2014 when the children's refugee crisis actually erupted for the first time, mm-hmm. where the unaccompanied minors had arrived in large numbers at the border. There had been a surge, 60,000 kids stuck in the border. And in that moment, I was just starting to go on a road trip with my family.
And did you actually go to the border?
Yeah. I made successive road trips after that one. But what I did have at the end of that road trip and other trips were a series of Polaroid pictures of the country that told a story of, on their own, and a lot of notes about the crisis at the border. A kind of calling to write about the absolute solitude and horror that so many children were experiencing in the border.
Well, so let's go to Tell Me How It Ends, because that is in a way part of this novel. So you spent a period of time, I think maybe after that road trip, working or volunteering as an interpreter in the New York City Immigration Court for undocumented children. How did that come about? Was it a result of what you saw while on the trip?
Yeah, definitely. It was a result of the deep shock and rage and kind of uselessness that I felt, knowing that there were all these kids in the situation. And I asked a lawyer if there was anything I could do, any way to get involved. And she told me, yes, actually, we need a lot of volunteers in court translating the stories from Spanish to English that the kids tell their testimonies so that a lawyer may or may not take on and decide to to represent. So I ended up doing that for a long time and then wrote Tell Me How It Ends. I stopped writing the novel at some point because I realized that I was trying to use the novel as a kind of vehicle for my own politics and also as a space to kind of just tell the story of American interventionism in Central America. And I was really messing up the novel. So I stopped writing the novel. I wrote Tell Me How It Ends, which is a much more straightforward narrative of the problem back then. I mean, which is unfortunately still present and even graver.
So, and Tell Me How It Ends is nonfiction, sort of documenting that time you spent volunteering. After having the experience of volunteering, after writing Tell Me How It Ends, you went back to this novel you'd sort of begun and then put aside?
Yeah, when I was able to finish that, I was able to go back to the novel and not feel that it was my duty to tell that exact story in that novel, but write fiction.
Did you feel that there was something that you could do with this subject matter in fiction that you couldn't do in the nonfiction?
I mean, I am interested in fiction that doesn't merely mimic or reproduce the world, but fiction that understands that it has a role in the way we reckon, the way we understand and approach the world, and that is self-questioning about that. This novel constantly asks itself how to bear witness. How do you make audible the voices of those who are not regularly listened to?
And you used not only elements from your own life, but actually elements from Tell Me How It Ends, from your experience. There's one story in particular of these two girls whose grandmother was sending them across the border to find their mother and who sewed the mother's phone number into their dresses so that they wouldn't forget it. Why pull that story into the novel?
Well, this is a very personal reason, I guess, which is that it's a story that has haunted me forever, that obsesses me because I don't know what happened. I don't know what happened with those two girls. And I was a translator for their case and had the feeling when I was interviewing them that no one was going to be able to help them because they weren't able to articulate their story. They were 5 and 7 years old, so they weren't being able to tell the story the correct way, so to speak, so that a lawyer could then represent them in court and defend them from deportation. I had that feeling. Then a lawyer came and kind of reviewed my notes and asked them a few questions and also said that it looked like a very difficult case, that there probably wasn't a case. And that was it. That was the last I ever knew and heard. So there is, of course, this kind of this beating pain somewhere there that I came back to in the novel.
Yeah. And of course things now may be even worse for children at the border than they were back then. Do you feel, I mean, I don't think you've been there recently, but do you feel that things are radically worse for children arriving now?
I think they are. I think that the only positive thing in all of this is that more people seem to be preoccupied about it, that the sense of crisis has shifted from thinking that the crisis is the surge in arrivals to the inhuman way that children are treated. And at least the presence and the visibility of what is going on, I want to believe, will not allow for too much impunity on the side of political actors that execute violence on this population.
Well, thank you so much, Valeria.
Thank you so much.
Valeria Luiselli spoke with The New Yorker's Deborah Treisman. Her new book is called Lost Children Archive. You're listening to The New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
Welcome back to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. We hear constantly these days about driverless cars and how they'll change the world for better or for worse. T. Gregerson Boyle, Tom Boyle, recently read a short story on our podcast, The Writer's Voice, and it's about a very close relationship between a woman and her vehicle, to whom she's given the nickname Carly.
The car says this to her. Cindy, listen, I know you've got to get over to 1133 Hollister by 2 p.m. for your meeting with Rose Taylor of Taylor Levine and Rodriguez, LLP. But did you hear that Les Bourses is having a 30% off sale? And remember, they carry the complete Picard line you like, in particular that cute crossbody bag in fuchsia you had your eye on last week. They have two left in stock. They're moving along at just over the speed limit, which is what she's programmed the car to do, try to squeeze every minute out of the day, but at the same time wary of breaking the law. She glances at her phone. It's 1:15, and she really wasn't planning on making any other stops, aside from maybe picking up a sandwich to eat in the car. But as soon as Carly, that's what she calls her operating system, mentions the sale, she's envisioning the transaction. In and out, that's all it'll take. Because she looked at the purse last week before ultimately deciding they wanted too much for it. In and out, that's all. And Carly will wait for her at the curb.
I see you're looking at your phone.
I'm just wondering if we'll have enough time.
As long as you don't dawdle. You know what you want, don't you? It's not as if you haven't already picked it out. You told me so yourself.
And here, Carly loops in a recording of their conversation from the previous week, and Cindy listens to her own voice saying,
I love it, just love it. And it'd match my new heels perfectly.
Okay, she says, thinking she'll forego the sandwich. But we have to make it quick.
I'm showing no traffic and no obstructions of any kind.
Good, she says. Good. And leans back in the seat and closes her eyes.
D.C. Boyle reading from his short story, Asleep at the Wheel. You can hear the whole thing on our podcast, The Writer's Voice. This has been a very good year for the actor Richard E. Grant. He's no newcomer to the movies. He's already been in films by Francis Ford Coppola and Robert Altman. He's performed alongside Meryl Streep, so there's not much more you can ask for in a career. But this year, Richard E. Grant had what might be called his star turn in a film called Can You Ever Forgive Me? He plays a flamboyant grifter named Jack who befriends the troubled writer turned forger, played by Melissa McCarthy.
It's Jack Hawk. Last time I saw you, thank you, we were both pleasantly pissed at some horrible book party. Am I right?
It's slowly flooding back to me. You're friends with, Julia somebody.
Steinberg?
Yeah.
She's not an agent anymore. She died.
She did? Jesus, that's young.
Maybe she didn't die. Maybe she just moved back to the suburbs. I was confused those two. No, that's right. She got married and had twins.
Better to have died.
Indeed.
Grant was nominated for an Oscar, his first in three decades, in the movies. Visiting New York recently, though, he was the starstruck one. The New Yorker's Rachel Syme tagged along with him on a sightseeing tour of a very particular kind.
Richard E. Grant loves Barbara Streisand.
Don't tell me not to live, just sit and putter. Life's candy and the sun's a ball of butter. Don't bring around a cloud to rain on my parade.
He grew up in Swaziland, which is officially now known as Eswatini and is a tiny country between South Africa and Mozambique. His father worked for the British government there. When Richard was about 12, his family took a trip to Europe.
And the only movie that was in playing in Rome, when we were in Rome, that hadn't been dubbed, mm-hmm. was a movie called Funny Girl.
Of course.
Then, subsequently, I had seen What's Up, Doc, when she looked just unbelievable. And I was at full hormonal storm at that point. And so that's, you know, that was my fixation and obsession.
And you wrote her a letter.
I wrote her a letter
I
when I was 14. Dear Barbara Streisand, I sincerely hope this reaches you personally. You don't know me yet, but I'm writing to offer you an idea.
Like many other Streisand mega fans, Richard didn't get a response to his fan letter. But unlike so many other Streisand mega fans, Richard grew up to be an Oscar nominee. And when you're nominated for an Oscar, people start to pay a lot of attention to you, including, as it turns out, Barbara Streisand.
And my daughter called, and she said, "Dad, Barbara Streisand has tweeted you." And I went, what? And she, and
okay, here's the deal. Richard had Nicole tweeted out the text of his fan letter. And miraculously, 47 years later, Barbara replied.
Saying. And then I said, she tweeted a reply. She, are you pranking me? And I got quite angry. I said, "You're pranking me? No, you can't mess with me like this. It's too important." And
here's what she wrote. "Dear Richard, what a wonderful letter you wrote me when you were 14. And look at you now. You're terrific in your latest movie with Melissa. Congratulations and love, Barbara."
And I just lost it.
People who need people.
Richard happened to be in New York last week, and he said he wanted to visit the places that meant the most to his beloved Barbara Streisand.
God, where are we going? Oh, we're in Brooklyn.
Yeah.
I'm not looking.
We started our tour in the Flatbush neighborhood, where Barbara grew up.
Are you interested in origin stories of people?
Yes, because
you study them.
Yeah. That's why I'm obsessively read published diaries and autobiographies and biographies. I can remember when my wife came to Swaziland to visit for the first time when our daughter was 6 years old. And she said, "I now know who you are." Mm. You know, we'd been together for 8 years. But until you see where the person has actually come from and the smells that they've grown up with and the landscape, I think that really informs you. And so now I am in actual Streisand land. So it's like, yup.
Well, now you'll know.
This is where you started. And this is what you, at that time, escaped from.
You know, specifically, Barbara escaped from a drab brick housing complex on Newkirk Avenue in Flatbush.
It looks like a kind of prison.
Yeah, what does it make you think about?
The contrast between here and living in Point Tuna, Malibu could not be more extreme. You know.
So
is this where she lived? And when you opened the window, you just looked onto a brick wall?
I think so, yeah. I think she probably had an air shaft.
And now she's worth half a billion or more and counting. You did good, girl.
She did good.
I love that.
Wave your little hand and whisper so long, dearie, you ain't gonna see me anymore.
Oh, Richard loves a lot of things. And he loves them with unbridled enthusiasm. It's one of the best things about Richard. He has no chill. He loves being an actor. He loves being an Oscar nominee. He loves this particular kind of sea salt that he carries around with him everywhere he goes in a cloth bag. And Barbara might be the thing he loves the most. So, as you can imagine, it can get kind of intense.
I'll tell you what I would like. I'm interrupting you. I would like a 12-foot sculpture in my garden of her nose. That's what I would like. But, you know, saying it out loud to you, it's... This is...
Feels bonkers.
This is the musings of insanity. Yeah.
Would it surprise you if you learned that there were people that were as obsessed with you as you are with Barbra Streisand?
No, that's not possible. I know that's not possible.
How? I'm sure there are.
No, there are not. There are not. And I tell you what...
Our next stop is Barbra's high school, Erasmus Hall.
Okay.
So here we are.
This is it.
Richard, I kid you not, fell to his knees and kissed the sidewalk in front of the high school. He makes me try to go inside the high school with him, and a police officer stops us almost immediately by the metal detector.
Hey, man, hold tight, all right? Yeah. I'll be right with you guys.
I don't think that Richard knows how New York public schools work. Richard, can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
What was your high school experience like?
I was at school with Nelson Mandela's daughters, did school plays with them, because... Many political dissidents from South Africa sent their school to Swaziland because of multiracial tolerance more than anything else.
And that's about how long it took for us to be escorted from the building.
Well, that's better than I thought we'd do, actually.
Is it? We're out of the
prison. It's hard just to walk into a school.
You know, I'm amazed that there's no plaque or there's no
I know.
Acknowledgement.
They all seem to know she went there,
yeah.
But... So this is always a busy...
For our next stop, we, like Barbra, left Flatbush behind and headed for Times Square, right into the heart of the theater district.
Who is the pip with pizzazz?
So now we're going to the Winter Garden.
Who is as glamorous as? Who's an American beauty rose with an American beauty nose and 10 American beauty toes?
I mean, you're having an emotional season, yes? This is, I mean,
yeah,
you're Oscar nominated.
I'm almost 62. I've never had nominations. I've never been awarded anything. So it is an astonishment when this glut of attention, glut's not the right word, I know, gallop of attention. I mean, I went into the Apple store yesterday when I just landed to go and buy something, and four people offered to help me. I had four people just come up to me and say, hey, congratulations on your nomination. What can we do for you? So that was sweet for the moment that it lasted.
That seems like the ideal level of fame. It's not crazy, but you get really good service at the Apple Store.
I know, it's like, if I put this in Cinderella terms, the coach turns into a pumpkin on Monday the 25th of February. When the Oscars are done and dusted. The age that I am, the kind of parts that I get offered, I have no delusion, I'm not singing the blues about it, it's just, I have no delusions that essentially changes.
Mm.
Yeah. My point is, I'm enjoying the ride because I know that it's a finite experience. Here we are, Winter Garden Theatre.
We snuck into the back of the theatre.
Every time I've come to New York, I've come here because I know that this is like, you know, if you put this in religious terms, this is the cathedral where the person that I have faithfully followed did a show.
Can you imagine what it would be like?
Yeah, well, I listened to the recording this morning, just before I came here, of the finale of the final night, when she broke the fourth wall, as it were, and said, I'm going to sing My Man in honor of Fanny Brice. And the audience just goes completely insane at the end of it. And it was recorded in here. And it's a bootleg recording, but she did...
You're a true fan, you have the bootlegs. That's what, see, Barbra said you're a true fan. You are a true fan.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my man, I love you so. You'll never know. All my life is just despair, but I don't care when it takes me in.
Dear Barbara Streisand, I sincerely hope this reaches you personally. You don't know me yet, but I'm writing to offer you an idea you might like to consider. My name is Richard, and I live in a small African kingdom called Swaziland in Southeast Africa. Since seeing Funny Girl, we, my family that is, and I have been very big fans. I've followed your career avidly. We have all your records. I'm 14 years old. I read in the paper that you were feeling very tired and pressurized by your fame and failed romance with Mr. Ryan O'Neill. I would like to offer you a 2-week holiday or longer at our house, which is very beautiful, with a pool and a magnificent view of the Ezulwini Valley, which the Swazi people called Valley of Heaven. I think you will agree when you see it. Here you can rest. No one will trouble you, and I assure you, you will not be mobbed in the street as your films only show in the one cinema we have for 3 days. So not that many people will know who you are. So no chance of being mobbed. Please consider this respite seriously. You will always be welcome. Yours very sincerely, and in anticipation of a hasty reply, which came 47 years later, Richard.
Oscar nominee Richard E. Grant on Broadway with The New Yorker's Rachel Syme.
What if you do win?
Never gonna happen.
That's it for our show this week. And if you're not following us on Twitter, you really should. We'll keep you posted on everything that's going on here at New Yorker Radio. I'm David Remnick. See you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. Our team includes Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Jill Duboff, Karen Frillman, Cal Alia, David Krasnow, Caroline Lester, Louis Mitchell, Sarah Nix, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Emily Mann and Jessica Henderson. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.